Hello and welcome to the Classical Tulsa podcast. I'm your host, Jason Heilman. My guest today is violinist Rosica Goza, concertmaster of the Tulsa Symphony. An active performer and teacher, she'll be the featured soloist this weekend as the Tulsa Symphony performs Erich Wolfgang Korngold's Violin Concerto. On this podcast, we'll get to know more about Rosica and this fascinating piece. Rosica Goza, thank you for talking to us today.
Thank you for inviting me here, Jason.
Well, everyone sees you on stage at the TSO concerts. You're the last musician to come out. You signal the musicians to tune. You get your own applause even. But I don't think people really know very much about you. How did you come to perform with as concertmaster of the Tulsa Symphony?
When about 12 years ago, the orchestra came back from the ashes, I was asked to apply for the job, which I did, and within 2 days, I knew that I was going to be the concertmaster, so that's how it all started.
Where were you at that time?
I was teaching in the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville.
Now, you're not originally from the United States.
Correct.
So when did you come to the United States?
I came in 92 as a student at the University of Central Arkansas. It's a very unlikely place for a Bulgarian to go to, but the violin teacher there was one of the finest Bulgarian artists, and I felt very privileged to be accepted in his studio. As a matter of fact, the condition for me to study with him was to pass the test of English as a foreign language, or the TOEFL. So I didn't speak a word of English when he accepted me in the studio. And in 6 months, I prepared myself to pass the test.
So when did you know you wanted to become a professional violinist?
I don't know, because it just seems to predate myself being a self-conscious person, because I know myself playing the violin as far as I can remember going back in time. And somehow it was the most natural choice. It wasn't even a choice. In Bulgaria, the idea of amateur musicians didn't exist at all. So if somebody started playing the instrument, if they had any aptitude and were able to continue playing it, we just stuck with it and became the professionals. And so there was never a question.
So as far back as you remember, you played the violin.
Right, right.
And how is your training different than maybe kids in America learn the violin? Was there a big difference in Bulgaria?
Here in America, the Suzuki method is very popular, and it's very effective in the early development of musicians. In Bulgaria, Suzuki was and still is practically unknown. So I started with private lessons right away. I also had to go through a music aptitude test. That's something I remember, actually. I was barely 4 years old, and they had to test whether I had good ears, whether I had good sense of rhythm. They had me sing, and they actually examined my hands. That was part of the talent.
They measured your hands to make sure.
Well, for violinists, apparently it's very important that the pinkies are not too short. So that was one thing that my teacher wanted to make sure that I.
Pinky strength is very important. Yes, that's something people don't think about with the violin. And so, so you were trained in Bulgaria, and then why did you want to come to the United States to study instead of in your native country?
Well, I could have stayed there because I had just entered the conservatory, and I had wonderful teachers. It would have been a very different and interesting life. It would have been also a very difficult life because right around that time, the political and economic situation changed greatly. And when I started my freshman year at the Music Academy in Sofia, I remember that all of a sudden all of the food disappeared from the stores. And suddenly there was no enough electricity for everybody. So the winters got extremely cold. And all I wanted to do was play the violin and be as good as I could be. So in a way, it was a little bit of an opportunistic move on my part to come to the United States because I just wanted to be a musician.
And so apart from the crash course in English you had, were there some other culture shocks you encountered in moving to Arkansas?
Oh, yes, of course. My idea of America, of course, has been formed by all of the Hollywood films. yeah. ironically. And I just wasn't prepared for any of the laid-back life that I encountered. I was very grateful, though, that I wasn't pushed into the deep end of the pool right away, so to speak. So I had time to find my level with the language and just figure out how to do well academically. And also I had plenty of time to practice with no distractions.
And eventually that your education brought you to Cleveland, is that right?
Where? That's right.
So that was climbing the ladder in the United States?
Well, yes. Now, the irony is that my Bulgarian teacher actually is one of the most sought-after professors today in the United States. But when I came in 92, he was completely unknown. Right now, he teaches at Indiana University. He has a very big and very strong class. So, in a sense, I got the best of both worlds because he had all the time to dedicate to the handful of students he was teaching at the time. And at the same time, we got absolutely best instruction possible.
And so in Cleveland, you finished your doctorate.
That's right. Mm-hmm. So I worked with Linda Saron mm-hmm. there. And within my second year at the Institute, she and her husband, David Saron, who was the president of the Institute at the time, invited me to be their teaching assistant at Encore. And that was probably the most important finishing school mm-hmm. I've had. Because for 6 years, I sat on every lesson that they taught with students we shared. And I learned more from them than from anybody else in that process.
And so then you were finished and you had to go about building a career as a violinist. And I guess the big question is, how does a person do that?
Well, being on one's own is a very scary thing. When you're a musician, because in school there is always somebody to watch after and keep you from making not very smart musical decisions and just to show you things regarding style and so on. But I think I had that fear of being on my own from the very moment I came to the United States, and I took very careful notes. I still have the books from those, actually, from every lesson I've had, or just conversations and help with any great musician I've worked with. And because I knew that the time to be on my own was going to come sooner or later. And then you just forge through and figure out your own strengths. You figure out what your weaknesses are that you have to overcome. And every day becomes yet another self-teaching day, mm-hmm. and you get better with time. That's for sure.
Yeah. In the meantime, you're playing gigs, you're applying for teaching positions, you're taking auditions.
Well, yes, that was back then.
Yes. Yeah. The transition.
So while I was still finishing my doctorate, I got my first teaching position. Mm-hmm. And it was very much academically oriented, so I realized that maybe because of my language disadvantage, I should look into something that is a little bit more practical, like teaching the violin itself and playing. And then I was just very lucky to have the academic jobs I've had and at the same time have the opportunity to lead the Tulsa Symphony. Currently, I play with the Harrington String Quartet, and that has been probably the most important learning experience I've had, both artistically, also technically, and working with three other musicians, I also had to learn a lot of diplomacy. Because we all have very strong opinions when it comes to music, and egos can be bruised very easily.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that, and maybe switch gears a little bit. So you play first violin in the Harrington String Quartet, but you're also the concertmaster of the Tulsa Symphony, and you've been concertmaster of other symphonies. What's the difference between those two roles? I mean, obviously you play the solos on the violin in both cases, but there's something more to it, isn't there? They're quite different.
They are and they are not, because the elements of music, which when boiled down to the bare essentials, are pitch, rhythm, and tone. So those are things that have to be just right in both situations. Of course, in the quartet, the texture is always four voices or less. Well, sometimes if we have double stops, give or take a few more voices. Mm. But it's much simpler and much more transparent. So everything I do in the quartet has to be absolutely perfect. In orchestra, of course, it has to be perfect, but it has to blend with the whole section. Mm. And then it's just the same thing. The quartet is a small organism, while the orchestra is like a whole nation of people. And of course, there's the spatial distance between the different groups, which contributes to a different type of listening when I'm on stage with the orchestra. But as far as playing itself comes to playing, I'm still the same musician, because I take care of the same things. Also, as the first violinist in a quartet, I'm first among equals. While in orchestra, there is the conductor whose gesture and musical ideas I have to somehow communicate through my playing to the rest of the orchestra. So I hope this answers to the question.
Well, it's a different kind of leadership then, isn't it?
It is. Yeah. It is.
So does it feel more hierarchical in the orchestra? Do you feel like that's more of a top-down method than compared to the collection of equals in the string quartet, or is it something else?
I really don't know how to answer this question, because every situation is specific. Mm-hmm. I know that I really have to pay attention to what the conductor needs from the podium, but I also have to pay very much attention to what the soloist, and I don't mean the person standing in front of the orchestra, but whichever the leading voice at the time is, needs in terms of support from the violinists. I, as a concertmaster, of course, get to make a lot of executive decisions regarding bowings, regarding certain stylistic things of the playing. And over the years, because there is a certain consistency in the section with the people with whom we play in orchestra, it's not necessary to explain anything. I hardly ever turn back to say anything, because in rehearsal I can just point at the part of my bow and everybody knows that we have to be playing in the middle or at the tip or whatever. So it is just with time becomes a very well-oiled machine. And I actually love my time as a concertmaster here. When I go back to West Texas, I love my time with the quartet. I really have a hard time deciding which one I prefer.
And you also teach on faculty in West Texas.
Yes,
at West Texas A&M.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah. How does that, do you teach this art of being the concertmaster to your students? How does that come up?
Yes, there is a student orchestra there, and we have another violin teacher, the second violinist of the quartet as well. So it's not guaranteed that one of my students is going to be the concertmaster of the orchestra. But I coach sectional rehearsals with the students, and I try to show them as much as I can, because really you learn this art by doing it. Some institutions, Cleveland Institute of Music, for example, has a diploma for concertmaster training.
Oh, wow.
There are very, very few places in the world that do that. But I didn't go through the training there, but I had lots of opportunities to play as concertmaster before I got the job here. But after more than a decade of playing, I can tell you, it really is a job that you have to learn on the spot.
And speaking of being on the spot, this weekend you are going to be the soloist, the featured
yes.
soloist. And this is yet another role, from quartet musician to concertmaster, and now to the featured soloist. What is this harder, or maybe more familiar to you, or both? I mean, how does this performance going to be as soloist with your orchestra?
Well, I do hope that it's going to be great. I've been looking and dreading at the same time, just for a long time. For one thing, so far, every time I've played solo work with an orchestra, it's been a piece I've known for a long time or have studied at school. As a student, I worked a lot, so I built quite a repertoire. But about a year ago, I learned that the artistic committee has decided that I would be playing the Korngold Violin Concerto. And all of a sudden, I just realized, oh gosh, I better get started right now. First of all, it's in a style that was a little bit unfamiliar to me. You just don't play much Korngold in school. Mm. And when I got the score, my first reaction was, oh, what do I do now? Because there isn't a single fingering or bowing. There are lots of markings for the musician to read through the score, but for the performer, you have to figure out absolutely everything. And it's a concerto which is written in such a way that it sounds as if you're improvising it at the moment, the way a jazz player would. So the rhythm is very difficult to read. So for me, the initial stage of just getting familiar with the text was probably the hardest thing that I've ever done. It's very common among musicians to exchange parts with markings, mm-hmm. and because people come up with very good solutions or very bad solutions, and we all learn from one another. And I asked quite a few colleagues who might have played the concerto or studied it to share their parts with me. Nobody did. And so I had to figure it out all on my own. And it took a long, long time to get to that point. And then once I got familiar with the text, all of a sudden I realized that this is probably the piece of music that fits my personality the best. And I absolutely love every note from it.
Let's unpack that statement. Why do you think, why does the Korngold Violin Concerto speak to you personally or your personality?
Well, it's written in a late Romantic style, which also has become the Hollywood movie mm-hmm. style. That was what Korngold created for us. And I love that music. It's very easy for me to just wear my heart on my sleeve and play it.
Yeah. It's very expressive.
It's extremely expressive. There are lots of ways to play this music. It allows for all sorts of different slides and different inflections. And I had a great time figuring out every gesture, and I just love the freedom it allows me.
It's a very different piece of music from other contemporary or 20th century violin concertos.
Right.
Because it dates from 1947.
Right.
Which puts it after the Berg concerto and after the Bartok concertos. How do you stack it up against those pieces?
Well, I have studied both the Berg and the Bartok. I never dared perform either of them. They're just very complex, very different. In the Korngold, for certain, there are chromatic passages that took me a long time to even teach myself to learn how to hear. Mm. Which was a different challenge. I'm actually a little bit embarrassed to admit that I had that challenge, because at this point I'm supposed to, you know, just be able to play anything that is put in front of me. But certain passages took a lot of practicing, first on the piano, then to try to hear them tonally in order to be able to play them right. And with the Berg Violin Concerto, those challenges were much stronger and harder. The Bartok is a different animal altogether.
But yet at the same time, the Korngold Concerto is pretty tonal.
Oh, yes.
Yeah,
yes,
and so it's,
yes.
But it's just sort of an extended tonality, isn't it? Almost, you mentioned jazz earlier. Is that mm-hmm. where you feel like it comes out of, or...?
Well, the freedom in the rhythm notation for certain is an attempt to write down something that a really good jazz musician would do to a piece. Then also the middle section of the second movement of the concerto is pure improvisation, some of it is actually atonal. But it was especially in the first movement, some of the sevenths and ninths that were in the very high register of the instrument that were very hard to get right.
And then it has one of these sort of perpetual motion finales.
That yes, which is fun. Yes.
Do you have a movement in this concerto that stands, or a moment in this concerto that really people should listen for?
I think that the most special places are the softest ones in the second movement. Sometimes you have to experience something in its entirety in order to understand what exactly you have heard. And then you listen back in your head and you just think that's the most beautiful thing ever written. And every time I listen to the second movement, at the end of that movement, I don't think there's anything better than this.
Now, this was actually a flop when it premiered. Did you know that? That Yasha Heifetz gave the premiere, and one reviewer actually called the concerto more corn than gold.
Oh, how unfortunate.
And that might be a big part about why it hasn't really loomed large in your repertoire until now, that it's only recently that that people have been rediscovering it, I think since the 90s. Is that fair? I mean, what do you think about this? Now that you've gotten inside this concerto, how do you feel about it?
I think that every violinist should learn it. It's such a great work. Why they didn't play it, I don't know. And sometimes it's difficult to understand musical tastes. But I feel so fortunate that it has re-entered the mainstream repertoire. As a matter of fact, in the last couple of years, I think that in the communities where I've been as a musician, it's been played quite a lot, because I think in the spring, last spring, it was played here by a visiting orchestra from Dallas.
Oh, yeah, I think so.
With Cloyd Trevor. And a year or two ago, it was played in the Amarillo area. The Amarillo Symphony played that with actually another Bulgarian violinist, Bella Hristova. And now I'm playing it. So I feel that it has been played a lot around me lately.
We're helping to spark a renaissance of this piece.
I hope so.
So once you've conquered the corn gold this weekend, what violin concertos are still on the horizon for you? What are you still hoping to perform?
I never performed the Dvorak violin concerto. Also, Josie Winter, who is my dear friend here, in whose house I stay when I come to work in Tulsa, loves Bruch's Scottish Fantasy.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That's another piece that I have never performed, although I have studied it. So in the near future, I hope to get to play one or both of them.
Well, Rosica Goza, thank you for talking to us here today.
Thank you, Jason.
That was Rosica Goza, concertmaster of the Tulsa Symphony. You can hear Rosica perform Eric Wolfgang Korngold's violin concerto this Sunday afternoon at the PAC. For more information on that concert, visit tulsasymphony.org. That's our Classical Tulsa podcast for today. Look for more interviews with local musicians in the future. In the meantime, be sure to tune in to Classical Tulsa every Friday at noon on 88.7 KWTU and streaming on publicradiotulsa.org. I'm Jason Heilman. Thanks for listening.